Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the second session on Mara, the topic that we started last week. Now, in different places of the teachings, you come across this term, realm of Mara. Realm. So, the Pali word is Mara. It's one word, anyway. Mara Dehiya. Again, you don't, just for reference only, Mara Dehiya. Can everyone see? Okay. Mara Dehiya, realm of Mara. When Buddha was asked the boundaries of Mara's kingdom, and Buddha simply said, Mara's kingdom has no boundary. It's everywhere. It's everywhere. So Mara can be here right now. He could be in another, in a remote corner of the universe. Mara is everywhere. Now, only those who are fully enlightened live outside of Mara's realm. Now, so when in Buddhism, in the Buddha Dhamma, usually whenever you hear the word realm, it has a it has a connotation of physical boundaries, like of a kingdom, a country, a planet, etc. Whereas realm here means it doesn't have a physical boundary. It is simply all the sankharas. Everything is an example of you name something, and that is part, that is within Mara's realm. So this mobile phone is part of Mara's realm. One example is here, when I am addicted to this, if I don't play games, let's say I download all the games available and I am a game addict, and I wouldn't be doing anything else but playing games the whole day. Now, this phone itself, this physical object is part of the Mara's realm. And I use this to get lost in the Mara's realm. I get addicted. I get obsessed. I get deluded. And whichever word you use, it is everything that we do, everything that we experience could be, not should be, could be is an indication that we live within the realm of Mara. As opposed to
you just press the thing, it won't hang up, but it will.
This one?
You can, yeah.
As opposed to Buddha realm. There are two beautiful words, realm of Mara and the Buddha realm. Buddha realm. Now, you may have heard in popular Buddhism that we still live in the Buddha's realm, even though the Buddha has passed away, and even though he's gone, still his realm is here. Whereas, but one thing interesting is, Buddha realm manifests for a short period of time, whereas the Mara realm is out there all the time. So, the lifespan of the current Buddha realm started some 26 plus 100 years ago, and the lifespan of the current Buddha realm is 5,000 years. And previous Buddhas had their realms existed for a specific period of time. Now, however, Mara realm is always there. It doesn't, it is like, how to say, what is the word? Not immortal. It's perpetual, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's perpetual. It's perpetual, it's timeless. Perpetual. Mara realm is perpetual, whereas the Buddha realm is timed. So from time to time, a Buddha has to appear in the world to rediscover Dhamma, so that people, again, they get access to the Dhamma. Now, so how, when you reduce these two realms, Buddha realm and the Mara realm, within the boundaries of a day-to-day life, right? Let's say from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m., from dawn to dusk, you create, while people create millions of negative or toxic feelings, they may be able to create only one or two feelings that are beneficial to their existence and others. See how it is understood? It has nothing to do with physical planets, but our emotions, our feelings, our tendencies. Now, if you, within 2 hours, you experience more of Mara than that of the Buddha. So that's how we understand Buddha realm and Mara realm psychologically. So that is when Buddha highly encourages us, given the moment, the mind would run away. And most of the time, so mind would take you to adversity. So that is how Mara realm and Buddha realm are understood. Now, going on the same dichotomy, Mara realm and Buddha realm, it takes a bodhisattva, somebody aspiring to be the Buddha, many eons, many millions of lifetimes to complete his perfection, the 10 perfections or the paramitas. We did talk about paramitas. Why is that? Because paramitas, it takes such a long period for a bodhisattva, somebody aspired to be the Buddha, to complete all the qualifications or perfections. A bodhisattva is not immune to Mara's attacks. Mara means, we understand Mara in terms of all these 5 things. On and off, we come across that the possible, there are incidences in the Tipitaka, in the Buddha's canon, that Mara, the first Mara appearing and trying to tempt a Buddha. Most of the time, throughout the Buddha's teachings, even without reference to the term the Mara itself, Buddha explains how people get deluded within the realm of Mara. When you are obsessed with your physical body, for example, you're obsessed with your physical body. What is called raga. Raga or raga towards your own image, your figure. So people can get into trouble very easily. Some people are never happy with their appearance. And it is, by definition, it is considered when somebody is overly concerned with their physical appearance, it amounts to a mental disease, mental disorder. Of course, some people go through treatment so that they have to get treatments. And I personally know some people from different backgrounds who got depressed and who got psychiatric treatments. because they are beautiful people. I mean, they are nice people. They look, but they are not happy with that. So that is when I have come across three or four girls in California way back in 2002 or 3, I guess. They had the same problem because they live in California. Why? California is famous for Hollywood. Beyond the Sunset Boulevard, that's where I used to live, like 2 miles away from, 2 miles north of Sunset Boulevard. Sunset Boulevard is the kind of boundary of the where the celebrities live, Hollywood area. It was a fascinating research that how some girls got addicted to makeups when they were as young as 8, 9 years old, during their formative years. Why? That is what they would always see. They got highly influenced by the Hollywood culture. So that is one example for the second one, Kandamara. Kanda means the five aggregates, selfhood mara. Overall, our appearance, the way we self-identity, appearance, all these terms fit in the definition of Kandamara. So I always try to come up with a secular definition, not a religious one. Because that is when the beauty of the Buddha Dhamma manifests, right? So it has not. Yes.
Would it be true to extend that obsession to an obsession with fitness? To
yes.
The detriment of the body?
Exactly. So exactly.
Things like anorexia.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a terrible condition. That's true. Anorexia. Yeah. I wonder whether in one of my previous talks I mentioned that years ago I happened to counsel girls suffering from anorexia. No surprise, they live in France, Paris. They're from, I traveled to Paris. I spoke with them through an interpreter, anorexia. Because they wanted to be more skinnier, and they were not happy with their... They had become skeletal. But they were still... And then one girl had a problem with it because she was so skeletal. Her legs were like... It's not offensive. Relatively, her kneecap was way bigger than the muscles of upper part and lower part of her legs. It's like a bubble. That was the problem. However, she wanted to wear her skirt above the knee, of course. However, a doctor suggested that she wear the skirts. No, then I'm not a village girl. That was her response. I'm not a village girl. I don't need long skirts. So then I suggested that she only wear jeans. Then I said, one critical question she asked me. Bhante, do you think I look more beautiful, more attractive when I am in jeans? Oh, you got it, honey, then I said. You got it. I didn't say yes or no. I had to do a very tactful answer. You got it. A very tactful answer. And she was happy with that. And Buddha recommended these kind of answers. Tactful, upaya. U-P-A-Y, upaya. Upaya means tactics.
Yeah. Monks get trained to answer these questions. Whatever you say, it's going to be...
That's true, yeah. Yeah, because that's the way you make someone happy, because as long as it doesn't do any more harm, it may not do any more good. But however, it could be a preventive measure. It's a preventive measure.
Do you think that there's a lot of these obsessions became a lot worse during COVID and during the lockdown.
Exactly.
People were stuck at home and not able to see anyone.
That's right. Actually, exactly. I think it's going to affect our life at least for the next 20 years or so. Because day by day, a lot of people call for counseling. In fact, I myself had some certain kind of weird feelings after the COVID. Then I noted that when I even jolted it down, I came up with a long list of things, that I was missing. In fact, when I noted that I wasn't missing anything. Everything was there. Then I had to cross out the list, the whole list, there's nothing. But again, then I went into deep meditation and I thought, so now that is the kind of vibes now. A world filled with all these negative things. People's vibes affect us. Now, a lot of people come up since I came back to the temple, Vihara this time, a lot of people call. And some came for a chat, for a counseling session. Finally, when I spoke with them, they weren't missing anything. They are okay. They were okay. The problem is I happened to say, the pre-pandemic world doesn't come back again. It's gone. Now we have to just adapt ourselves to the post-corona world. And it has a lot to do with economics, economic instability, downturn. When the last few weeks ago I mentioned that an Uber driver told me, a young guy, how frustrated he was. He was extremely frustrated. That is how everyone is frustrated. Skyrocketing consumer prices. And people don't feel like that they are, even if they have a best relationship somehow, more people prefer to live alone rather than in a relationship. The world has been the way as long as we know, since the millennium, since the year 2000. However, after the pandemic, situation has worsened. That's worsened in the way that there's no way that people have relief from it. There's no remedy for that. The only thing is a discussion. So I had to have a long discussion with everyone who visited. Long discussion had to motivate them, whether they had, and then everyone accepted. One girl cried, and, yeah, Bhante, I think I haven't lost anything. But again, and go ahead and say you lost something. Yes, that's what I'm going to say. Do you want to go to another round of discussion? No, you have already spoken to me for like 2 hours. So then anorexia, obesity. And as we all said, that is, I think, years ago we talked about food mara. Probably not in a class like this. I think when I was talking to a group of school children. Years ago, I happened to talk to a food mara. When they talked about the devil in Buddhism, I said, no, there are different, the devil can attack us in different ways. Let me talk about a different kind of mara. Then I said, food mara. Food mara, I mean, how food becomes our mara. It can attack some. When you get addicted to food, and so that it can cause medical problems, so you can put on weight. Not the medical condition or obesity, but when addiction can, due to addiction to food, you may put on weight, thereby inviting a lot of medical problems. At the same time, the other extreme of food mara is that you may get anorexia. The two extremes of mara. That's actually food mara. That is one of the regular topics that they talk about. How devil attacks us, the devil, and as in their language, devil or the mara, addictions. So that is the kanda, kilesa. Kilesa mara is second one. Kilesa literally means that which defiles, that which adulterates our mind, kilesa, a force, any tendency, any feeling, any emotion, any thought that adulterates the purity of our mind. In other words, that is the toxic. How our mind become toxic. Kilesa. Is Mara itself. The well-known agents of second Mara are jealousy, anger, jealousy, and raga, sexual feelings. These are among the most intense agents of second Kilesa Mara. Most people invite second Mara into their life. I'm looking at the Mara here literally, but not the Deva Mara, not Mara the deity. So that is when I happened to say the last week that we put the blame on Deva Mara deity, but in fact, what impacts our lives and day to day life every moment from dawn to dusk are the other four Maras, the third, fourth, and fifth Mara. Of them also, we can clearly identify the second and third Maras for recording purpose. The first one is Deva Mara, Mara the deity, which is an external force. Kanda, our selfhood, our five aggregates of kilesa, defilements, abhisankara, karma, machu, one-time Mara. The Mara, the last one, death itself is Mara. The last Mara attacks on only once. He doesn't need much time. See, I happen to say, I personify this one. He, Mara, the death. In literature also, it says that, I wonder whether Mara, when Mara comes, he could be here any moment. He could be here anymore, because we love to personify, like in karma. Especially in the Western Western perception, Mara is considered, karma is considered an individual. So that is why especially youngsters, I hardly hear in England, but in America I always hear that, where children, teenagers say in the karma guy. Karma guy. So we personify, and we find it comfortable to deify or personify realities, mental, our inner tendencies also. So when it comes to the biggest impact that would the Mara that would have the biggest impact on our day-to-day life is the Kanda Mara and Kilesa Mara. Our selfhood. Overall, our selfhood. Second, toxic feelings. Kilesa. Kanda and Kilesa. Third one is Abhisankara. Third one is the imprints. Imprints created by the first two Maras. Imprints, which is the third one, Kilesa Mara. And also, we talked about a lot about impression the last week. Impression means both good and bad. So for example, we need, let's say you want, you always expect a beautiful smile. Early morning, you expect someone, you hope that's your next door neighbor. No, next door neighbor would never smile with me. And most people would say, so let's say you meet someone almost every day, and then the one thing that you want from that person is a smile, or hello. Now, both good tendencies and good bad tendencies both lead to kilesa. How is that? Now, when, for example, love, there's someone who says you have a partner, the partner loves you. Now, no matter, say, your partner would never miss his or her favorite phrase, I love you. every day and night, every morning, every evening, your partner would say that. But I have spoken to people who boast about having the best partner in their life. But however, when I ask whether they were happy with their relationship, yes, and when I further ask them, not really. They would say, not really. Then I, what do you mean by not really? Well, you know, she loves me, he loves me, but sometimes I wonder, what if he or she leaves me one day? But you feel like she would never leave, right? He would never leave you. Yeah, I mean, she told me, she has told me many times, he has told me many times, we're going to stick together for life. But then why do you say, not really? And then they would talk about, say, I never want others to look at her, look at him. All these things, right? So I had never come across a couple who would, I mean, among these, the couples who would boast about their relationships. And so that in lengthy dialogues, none of those couples had told me that their life is perfect. Sometimes they would come late and make a phone call individually and say something. They would have a private dialogue with Bante and would say that, you know, I'm so lucky to have her in my life, him in my life. But I also feel like, what if I lose her one day? Lose him one day. At least you live, literally you don't have a problem. But we are so addicted to, as human beings, we are sattvas, right? Sattva, remember that definition, S-A, T-T-V-A, sattva. Sattva means sentient beings, we are beings. So that we are, our attachment is our identity. Now, one of the characteristics of attachment is doubt, suspicion. What if I lose my partner? What if? So, even if the relationship is perfect, some people still they imagine too much. Imaginations play a big role in our lives. That's called premature imaginations. Something negative has never happened, but still people prefer to think, what if something negative happens?
This would be
Kilesa. Kilesa. That's the Kilesa one, yeah. Abhisankara is the imprints. Imprints created by Kilesa, and overall Kanda and Kilesa, Abhisankara, imprints. Karma are the imprints. Karma could be, is in the singular, right? Karma is what is called imprints created by Kilesa and Kanda. So that is why Abhisankaram are always goes unnoticed. It goes unnoticed. It comes to, we never know when Abhisankara Mara would come back and attack us. So we create all these Maras actually. So we create Mara, except the first one. Now, when it comes to the last one, Machu, that is death. Now, one of the synonyms for Nirvana is deathlessness. When you achieve Nirvana, you never die. Why? How could you die? Because you are never reborn into the Mara realm. Deathlessness. And that is the only time you can, every time you come back to life, you have to face all these Maras, including the last one, Machu, death.
What's the difference? difference between abhisankara and sankara?
Yeah, sankara is the active, experience. Sankara in layman's language is experience. Now, whereas abhisankara is the imprints of experience. As we have experienced something, we leave some memories, we create some memories thereof. Memories and certain energy, a certain impact. And that impact continues to remain in our consciousness. And that is the same intact get reactivated and come back to our life. And that is when, say, karma just returned to my life. Or karma is attacking me. Sankara and abhisankara. Sankara is experience. Like kaya sankara, bodily experience. Vachi sankara, verbal experience. And mano sankara, mental experience. So,
same as karma vipaka.
Karma vipaka, yes, exactly. Karma vipaka, abhisankara. Abhisankara is the karma vipaka and the parivartana. Vipaka. Vipaka is the consequences. Results of karmic results, abhisankara. So that is another hiding. So now we may lose, upon death we would leave khanda, our selfhood behind. However, we take abhisankara with us. We take karma. Karma includes, karma always travels with habits and memories. So the memories, karma and habits, we get them embedded into our consciousness. When the consciousness creates another birth, that's called bhavanga, and we did talk about in our previous, bhavanga, B-H-A-V-A-N-G-A, bhavanga. So bhavanga is like, in Judeo-Christian religions, it's all. So when the consciousness of a departed person enters the mother's womb, thereby enters an embryo, thereby creating another birth, another being. And so the abhisankara mara gets reactivated. And so that is when we carry abhisankara mara travels with us. Wherever we go, we may not take kilesas, but not the kilesas, but the imprints of kilesas. Because kilesa means you are angry. When you say, I am angry, anger. So I am angry means you are experiencing something. And out of anger, you create some imprints. Even if anger is gone, and the impact created by anger is still remains in our consciousness. And that becomes part of abhisankara. So punya papa, punya. Wholesome, papa, unwholesome, good karma and bad karma. So, abhisankara, kilesa. Any questions?
I actually have a question.
Yes, please.
With karma, just to understand, if something happened in the past, certain actions, and now we have the imprint, and that's karma.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
We can create new habits and create new karma.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We
can create new one. The karma already created would continually impact our lives. However, by creating new karma, you are able to push the impact of already the past karma to the sides. That is where the teaching of ahosi, defunct karma. Defunct means, let's say, by planting new karma, by creating new karma, so you push certain karma, you can delete them, you can't, but you can push them to the sides, so you create more karma, and you create more karma closer to the surface level of your consciousness, so that those newly created karma can become a temporary protective wall against the previous karmas. So that is where, that is why in Buddhism we don't believe in fate. Buddha's teaching is fatalistic. it doesn't believe, Buddha's teaching doesn't uphold the idea of fatalism. No fate but karma. Why? You can make certain changes to karma. So let's say, because of one thing that happened last week, and you are still going through the impact of that. You can concentrate, probably because you erupted in anger, you insulted someone, no matter how many times you apologize, but this is the first thing that something like that happened in your life, so that you become the topic in your workplace, and people would always talk about, and even your best friend is now not willing to get closer to you, right? And they think that you are still angry, but actually your anger is gone. However, the impact created by your anger is still there. It is so powerful that you still feel like when everyone is still looking at you. Probably, even if, let's say, over time, even if the people is long forgotten, and every time you encounter, you meet up with the people who were present at the scenario, and you feel guilty. So that is an impact of your karma. Whereas, now that you have apologized to everyone, and everyone accepted that, so that you, so then you begin to feel normal again, and then you make up, well, people commit mistakes, people happen to get angry, and people happen to, and I never planned that, it happened, so that it's over, and you slowly begin to heal yourself. Then what happens is, when you make up your mind, it's gone. And that is when you are planting a new karma. You are planting a new karma.
A good karma.
It's a good karma. It's a good karma then. And from that, then your guilt become less and less and less. And so all of a sudden, one of your friends would come to you and, hey, I just saw you, I see you are smiling today. That's what we all want you to smile, because you hadn't smiled for the whole week or so. And these things actually happen in your day-to-day lives. Now, that is when you plant a new karma. Now, karma is Chetanaham Bhikkhave Kammam Vadami. Chetana, C-E-T-A-N-A. Chetana is volition or intention. Karma, a certain feeling, certain action, doesn't produce any karma unless Chetana is involved.
There are neutral things, aren't there?
There are neutral things too, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Things that we do that are neither good nor bad karma.
Yeah. Neutral things have a lesser impact. But however, in case you happen to think about neutral things, neutral karma, thereby they could become a kind of karma that could impact your life.
Does it apply also to generational karma?
That's true, generational, yeah. Mm-hmm. Sigmund Freud never wanted to accept that because he was a neurologist. He talked about this, what is called ancestral karma something, somewhere. He has touched on that, ancestral, but he never wanted to, he did everything possible not to become spiritual. Whereas his contemporary and junior, Carl Jung, and he was more spiritual. Generational karma, so going along the idea of generational karma now, this neuroscientist, I think we did talk about that multiple times. Neuroscientists are, of course, such research is based on evidence-based research, not lab research. How people's, how karmic impact could be passed down from one generation to another genetically. Genetically transmitted karma. Genetically transmitted karma. So when mind is present in everybody's cell, if you are, if you, if you are always angry, right, and you could pass that, so let's say a mother is pregnant now, and the mother is very angry, and so that she could feed her child with her mano sanchetana ahara, the anger. So we call thought a food of thoughts. Mother's food of thoughts, so it is one of the nutrients. That's called the nutrients of thoughts. Mano sanchetana ahara is a food. So anger, which is a nutrient of thought, could become how to say ahara or the food to the child in the womb. So a mother's anger could impact the child. Now, so according to certain neuroscientists, certain children born to, let's say, a mother had a mother has three children. When they were in a relationship, and third child, when halfway through the pregnancy, she went through divorce, and she got traumatized by the sudden departure of her husband. And the third child would have a different, show different behavior, different behavior. And the third child's behavior could be different than the behavioral patterns of the elder ones. And it happens during the corona too. The children who were born during the corona pandemic period, they are shy and they are not so social. And some parents told me because this child was born during the pandemic. So sometimes those who were born during the pandemic and they... So that they experience pandemic, so they grew up without socializing. So they are very different, whereas those who are, now it is understood because people had to shut themselves off the world so that children didn't have any company. But some were born during some women conceived during the pandemic period. And they delivered the baby during the pandemic period. And so the children now, they say that now they are in the nursery, in preschool. They have a different lifestyle. It is a generational thing again. So it's a new generation. Some people call the pandemic generation. They are very different than the teachers say. So this batch of children, they are very different than the previous batches. And so that is how karma impacts our physical body as well. So it's a genetically transmitted karmic impact. Not karma itself, karmic impact. Two different things. Because you can have a mother's karma. Mother cannot inject or give her or share her karma with the child during the pregnancy, but her behavior, the impact, emotional impact due to her karma could be passed down to the child. It happens. That's abhisankara, the kile abhisankara, yes. Now it is because mind is present in everybody's cell. That is how our body gets charged, goes through the karma. When you are angry, you are shivering in anger, in fear. See that when you are shocked, and it causes the drop in immunity, right? Immunity drops. Why? It's due to fear shock. Now fear is a mental condition. However, immune system is not something mental, it is physical. But emotions impact your body. So that's when I had to do upaya things in Sri Lanka a lot. Upaya means tactful things. People only wanted, some people, let's say, somebody got shocked because they believed that they saw a ghost or something, especially in Sri Lankan culture, and they wanted a monk, someone. And sometimes they say, some of the lay people rush to that home and they bless. However, the patient person, no. And they say, I need a monk, something. But I didn't have any special power. Probably I didn't do any paritta chanting or anything. I'm honestly saying this. However, when I went there and then I touched the head and she would open her eyes, oh, you are here. Okay. So that's how the presence. It's a cultural thing too. But when I said that to a monk said, don't, as a monk, you are not supposed to say that. Why is that? No, because people believe that you have power. I never want people to believe that I have power. I don't have anything. I don't. How and why could I say that I do when I don't?
Well, surely you're stimulating something in that person.
That's right, because her belief.
Something for themselves.
That's right, yeah.
They don't, mm-hmm. If they don't realize it, it's
yeah.
Not helping them.
Yeah, exactly. Why I said that is her cultural memory. Cultural memory, that's also because memory, habits and karma, all these three things together, we call abhisankara, because that we experience something. Sankara, S-A-N-K-H-A-R-A, sankara is experience. So our experience is manifold. So experience of habits, experience can create new habits, experience can create, addiction. Experience and create karma itself. And experience definitely create memories. All these three things are inseparably intertwined. Karma, habits, and memories are inseparably intertwined. They are a single entity. A single force of the mind. Abhisankara. So the cultural memory plays a bigger role in our memories. So in Sri Lankan culture, when the monk was present, they were happy. Mm-hmm. So that's what I did. Two ways. So anything else? So now the kilesa and abhisankara. So kanda is the most complex one. Did I say that it's all from most external to the most internal, most manifest, most visible to the most invisible. Mm-hmm. Now, Deva Mara is so too external, that is somewhere, we don't see that, too big. Mara, the deity. Kanda, selfhood Mara, is very visible to us. It's me, myself, my life. I'm here, I'm existing, I'm living. That's Kanda, so I can see. The second Mara, myself, it's me, myself. And third one is Kilesa. We can feel it, because in terms of through our feelings, sensations, we can feel it. Now, but how it is more subtle than, is more invisible than the Kanda. Third one is much more invisible than Kilesa, because it is part in our sub, it is our, in our, in our subliminal mind. It is deep in our consciousness. Abhisankara. The last one, it doesn't apply. That is the Mara that ends our existence with one stroke. So the... any other questions?
What have you written down the side by that big bracket?
This one?
Internal.
This internal.
Internal,
yeah. The last four are internal. The first one is external. Next week I will talk about anusaya again. The seven obsessions. next week. We did talk about, but this is one another, it's another big topic. It'll require at least 3 sessions. Now again, when going back to the, we did talk about the Deva Mara the last week, I guess, right? Deva Mara, the handsome deity, handsome. So according to biography of Venerable, how to say, he's Venerable Moggallana, one of the disciples of Buddha, who was Mara, who was a Deva Mara for some time. So it is a position so because Deva Mara, Mara is a deity. If I say you must be lucky, it is a very highly contested position. Deva Mara, highly contested position, Deva Mara, because according to the Buddhist cosmology, the highest heaven, the sixth heaven, the sixth sensual heaven, Paranimitta Vasavati. Paranimitta. Nimitta means created. Vasavati means, overpowering. You rule over. That is what Vasavati means. V-A-S-A-V-A-T-T-I. Vasavati. Vasavati. Especially in Sinhalese, Sinhala-speaking people, when there's one regimental child, and the parents would all say, I can't live with this Vasavati. Because you can, because he would always do something that others cannot stand. Vasavati. My mother used to call me. I was the Vasavati in my family because I was very hot-tempered and I would do something nasty. But the next moment I was apologetic and in meditation again. One of the Hindus in my area, and he came and he was my father's friend. And he told me that, I think this, and he told me one, son, at times you are God, you are, and the next moment you are devil, and next moment you are God again. So, Vasavati means ruling over, rule over. Paranimitta, para means by others, nimitta means created. Now this is the overall meaning of the name of the sixth sensual heaven. It has the highest, the higher the heaven, it has more comfort. It has more luxuries. There are 6 sensual heavens, and there are 16 spiritual heavens. The 16 spiritual heavens are called the Brahma worlds, because Brahmas are spiritual deities. They are not sensual deities. They are not after comfort. They don't have raga. They don't have sensual raga. They only have raga for their physical body. That's all. Now, of the sixth heaven, the luxuries or the divinity of the sixth heaven is such that, say, if you are a deity, now you think that I need this. You think of something and it appears before you. That's the kind of luxuries the devas in the sixth heaven. Now, they are, according to one of my professors, and he said, the sixth heaven is the most ultra-materialistic heaven. They are not spiritual at all. They are always by luxuries. That is why Mara is born into that heaven. He promotes luxuries. He hates spiritual people. I know one of my fathers in my village in Sri Lanka, and he would hate monks, spiritual. He hates full moon days because he is extremely rich, and he had a lot of mistresses, and he was not married. And he had a lot of mistresses, and he has so much money that nobody would say a word against him. But he hates temples, monks, spiritual people, and in case he sees a woman or a man early in the morning on the full moon day, clad in white and walking to, going to temple, passing by his property, by his house, with incense sticks and coconut oil to burn lamps and also flowers, and then he would talk to them in filth. So my father, I remember that he told me, now that is how Vasavati, that's how the Mara is. You don't have to do anything wrong. Those who are addicted to luxuries, they hate spiritual people. And he told me, if you want to see Deva, the first Mara, look at him. You don't have to do anything wrong to them. You don't have to insult them, offend them. They simply hate your presence if you are spiritual. So that is how the Deva Mara is. And he is also one of the most handsome men in Navila, I remember. A big build. He had a lot of mistresses. That's when, and later on, my elder sister told me that. Our father has limits in explaining him. And then later, my elder sister told me. I was understanding enough. I was, I guess, 8. I was 9 years old. I could understand, and she explained to me the Vasavati Mara, why. And then one day, when the head monk of the temple was going for his evening walk, he had gone for an evening walk too. He was coming back from his evening walk, that man. And he scolded him, he spoke to him in filth. And teenagers got so angry, and then whatever they could pick, like stones, pebbles, clubs, anything, any object, they started attacking him. And then he was nowhere to be seen for 1 week or so. And then that's when I didn't know, that is when later my mother and my two sisters were laughing. I was coming home from the temple, attending Sunday school. And that is when they were laughed, and I asked, what's the matter? And then they told that even the Mara, Mara's power is not forever. So that's it. I remember that phrase. So Mara is such that he's a deity. He hates, he never wants you to become spiritual. And in case you are spiritually so powerful, and then that is when I asked, mentioned last week, he would appear before you when you are in meditation, appear before you like another person observing precepts, clad in white and very humble and paying respect to you. I appreciate your precepts. You are much higher than me, sir, ma'am. Really? Yes, you are the best. And then what happens is, from the next full moon onwards, you would be reluctant to observe the precepts. You will lose interest in meditation. Why? Because that supernatural figure, maybe a deva, deity, appeared before me and say that I am the best person. Why meditate more? Why more precepts? That's how he attacks. That's how the Mara tempts you. Temptations. He plants ego in your mind. He massages your ego.
It's actually activation of delusion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's when elsewhere, when we talk about help from certain supernatural beings, and then it is, while it is explained in the sutras, when your mind is at peace, even when your heart is good, when you are virtuous, even devas will come down to the earth to worship you. Whereas when your mind is polluted, so even goblins means these earthbound terrestrial, negative spirits. Even they would even rule you over. Why? because your mind is negative. When your mind is positive, and devas would worship you. And going on a supernatural extent, devas, you have to create your inner grounds for deva, divine beings to come and help you. Simply by praying to them, they wouldn't come for help. When your mind is pure, they would come to you without being invited. So that's one reference in one of the suttas in, I think, Samyutta Nikaya. Yeah, Samyutta Nikaya. Sakya Samyutta. When God King Chakra was, and he used to bow down to a certain corner, certain angle of the universe, and then his assistant Matali asked, "Oh Lord, why you are paying you are the king, you are the king of heavens. Is there anyone else above you?" And then he replied, "There are in the human world there are human beings who are virtuous, who doesn't do any harm to anyone else, and they live in kindness. They practice kindness, metta, so that I am paying my respect to him, them. They deserve my respect." So that is the place that humanity and divinity are placed in Buddhist spirituality. It doesn't matter you are divine or human. What matters is your good heart. Good heart. Now, I have seen some people in Sri Lanka, they go to these certain areas where the deities, temples, devales, and then they do all kind of cursing. And they ask the God to come down and, okay, please split that person, my next door neighbor's head, into 7 pieces. And then they smash a coconut. Right? They do that a lot. Curse. Sri Lankan, Buddhist culture, Sri Lanka got it from in a neighboring country, actually. They do that in certain temples here too. I mean, not Buddhist temples, not Buddhist viharas, non-Buddhist places, because this is a recording. They do the coconut smashing. But now, and people call it spiritual. Now spirituality is different. It's a definition of in the Buddha Dhamma. If you go to such a temple of a sort, and then you do the coconut smashing and you curse someone, you ask the malevolent divine beings to come down to help you, not the benevolent one, malevolent ones, Michaditika and Sammaditika, and it is still a religion. People call it religion. So that is where the word religion is misleading. If you ask a devil worshipper, they would say, I'm religious. So that is why I always find the term religion troublesome. So in certain religions, you don't do anything good. Actually, you are there. Your role is to curse someone. Because when I studied African traditional religions, ATRs, there are certain priests, they only do bad things for others. Not good things at all. But they are also highly revered, like devales or certain god temples in Sri Lanka.
Witch doctors,
voodoos, right? In African traditional religions, in Cuba and African babalawos, and different names. You name it, there are kinds of priests out there, and their duty is to help people, to get someone dead, not to make someone survive. So, but still, it is religious. Now, the first one would love them. Why? The more angry you are, Mara the deity would love you more. Why? Because you are not promoting spirituality. You are not promoting goodness. You are promoting evil. So the Mara is the, how to say, Mara is the enemy of Buddha. Like in Christianity, you say the devil is the enemy of God. But there's a difference when it comes in Buddhism. We always understand world is Mara Deya, realm of Mara. The world is full of Mara perpetually. Whereas from time to time, a Buddha comes, Buddha appears and helps certain number of people to walk away from Mara Deya, the realm of Mara. So that is why the timeline during which the Dhamma is present is very important. Because people have access to Dhamma to become good ones. Because Buddha is not a savior. He can save you, he can guide you. Right? Buddha cannot save you. Akkhataro. Buddha chose you the path. Dhamma itself is the path. Because Buddha never wanted to become, how to say, a person or a teacher. He was reluctant to claim himself to be a teacher. So when he was asked what he was, whether he's a teacher, who is your teacher? And Buddha said, I don't have a teacher. Now, are you a teacher yourself? No, I'm not a teacher myself. Then who is your teacher? Dhamma is my teacher. Now, his wisdom itself is Buddha's teacher. Now, whereas when teacher, Buddha rejected the idea of the ideology of teacher that was prevalent during his time. Now, in his society, a teacher was such that the teacher rules over knowledge. A teacher is someone who rules over knowledge. Now, teacher is higher than knowledge. Whereas in the Buddha Dhamma, in the Buddha's case, and Buddha said, no, knowledge is higher than teacher. It is the knowledge that creates a teacher. So the teacher...
That's logical.
That's logical, yeah. So that's when Buddha wanted to do that. Otherwise, Siddhartha would be an ordinary person. Thanks to enlightenment, he became the Buddha. Now, it is because of his enlightenment itself that he was identified as the Buddha. So that's why he was reluctant to call himself a teacher, even though he was. But it's logical, actually. He just wanted to counter. He just wanted to, how to say, one of my professors told me that he wanted to give spiritual people a shock treatment. Because always, Buddha never wanted to people to run after him like crazy. Oh, he's the Buddha, no, I'm, oh, please. He never wanted that.
Okay, this is a bit unrelated to the question.
Mm-hmm.
There are named arahats in the scriptures.
Mm-hmm.
Who named, how did they get named? Did the Buddha say, oh, you're an arahat? And that was recorded. And then suddenly the other arahats say, oh, this other person is saying arahat.
Both, yeah. It's like a code language too. Like for example, when you speak a code language, let's say, the king security apparatus, and so there are different levels of admin. I mean, there are different levels of that. Sometimes the highest ranking security officers, they have their own code language, and the junior officers wouldn't know what you're going to say by using codes. So now, enlightened people can identify other enlightened people, and in both ways. So because Buddha would identify certain arahats, and certain arahants would identify other arahats.
And did that continue after Buddha's death?
Yeah, continued. Yeah, but however, when the arahants became less and less and less, so that ability was gone. Because there was no one to do that.
Yeah, do you know, do you have
have any idea how long it took to die off? When was the last recorded
poem? According to Sri Lankan chronicles, Maliyadeva was the last recorded arahat.
When was he?
Kurunagala. From
in Boston?
I think that was in... I wonder... I need to...
Is it before or after Buddha Gosha?
Much after that.
Ah.
Much after that. During the Kurunagala period.
Okay.
Kingdom, mm-hmm. Yeah. Much later.
So,
mm-hmm.
fact that the particular monk,
mm.
is arahat, was it publicized or...?
No. That's where the problem is. It wasn't publicized, but however, talking about arahats would be one of the regular topics during the Buddha's time. Because everyone was trying to become arahats. And there were there were a lot of arahats person would be present now, and that says a lot, because it has become less and less and less nowadays. Actually, that is the natural thing too, because now the sasana is going to halfway through now, 2,600 years already. Now
it's in the decline,
beginning decline now.
It's almost become like taboo.
Mm-hmm.
To talk about arahats, who are you?
Mm-hmm.
Just to be talking about
actually, yeah, yeah. People do talk about them. Now the problem is, there are a lot of monks who claim to be arahats, but their behavior doesn't show that.
Yeah.
Now, so that is why some people are now, especially in the Sri Lankan context nowadays, there are certain monks who claim to be arahats. And the kind of thing that they do is so annoying. That so annoying. Myself, I'm one of them. I get annoyed all the time. I personally know some of what they do in their personal life, but they in public they say, "Okay, I'm an arahat." And where the Buddha says now, the sasana has three levels: pariyatti, P-A-R-I-Y-A-T-T-I, pariyatti. Pariyatti, the teaching itself, that's the first level. Second level is patipatti, P-A-T-I-P-A-T-T-I, patipatti. Patipatti means practice. Teaching is there. So the first level of sasana is pariyatti, meaning teaching, dhamma. Second level is patipatti, you put the teaching into practice. And third level is pativedha, P-A-T-I-V-E-D-H-A, pativedha. Pativeda means enlightenment, third level. So here's the problem. You could claim to be the best teacher of pariyatti. Still, you are not doing any damage to the sasana. And so that you could boast about your practice. Nobody would come and see how many jhanas or how many levels of enlightenment. How many precepts you are practicing. People don't care. Where at that's the second level. Third level is pativeda. When you come forward and say, "I'm an arahant, my cousin is an arahant, so is and so an arahant," and all of a sudden there was this, it saw like 10 years ago, all of a sudden, members of certain monastic movements started claiming to be arahats. That is when I become very curious and suspicious. Then I personally spoke to certain arahats and said, why not from other groups? Only, I think you are theologizing, you are evangelizing the Buddha's teachings.
So it's almost like even if somebody was an arahat,
mm.
it will never take off.
Exactly, that's right.
Without the authority of the Buddha behind them,
mm-hmm.
there's always going to be doubts and...
Exactly, yeah. So the arahat wouldn't come forward and say, "Hey, I'm an arahat." Like, they don't have enlightenment parties, like graduation parties. Right? So that is why I always became curious. I questioned them. Yes.
The Buddha did say, though, like you're saying, it kind of follows through with what Buddha said, because Buddha said it's not going to be the earth, nor the wind, nor the fire, nor the water.
Mm.
And this is the term the sutta used, so don't remember, he said, but the worthless people who arise in the Sangha who...
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
Dhamma,
yeah. Exactly, yeah. So it's like a cancer.
Mm.
Mm.
Yes. Is there anything in the Vinaya Pitaka which prohibits a person
from
claiming.
Exactly. This is it. If you claim to be have achieved enlightenment without doing that, you lose your ordination, you lose your upasampada, your priesthood. And recently I encountered one arhat during my short stay in Sri Lanka. I encountered one arhat. He claimed. However, when I went to see him, I didn't tell him that I was coming. I was just passing by. But the way he was, I directly approached him and say, "Is it the way arahats behave?" He's very much younger to me. Is it the way? And he came and, I said, "No. If you are arahat, you never get tight-lipped or red face." You have claimed to be an arahat and you have a bigger following. You have so many followers now. Do you know if you, I don't know, I'm not qualified to judge you. I'm not here to judge you anyway. But based on what I have just seen, I have difficulty believing that you are an arahat. If I am right, you are not even a monk now. Bye-bye. I left.
I thought that when you lose your upasampada, you remain a samanera, right?
Yeah, you can go back to samanerahood and live. But you don't lose your ordination, you lose your upasampada.
Yeah.
You don't have to get reordained. But you had observed the 10 precepts, you can become a novice monk again. Because you lose, and in this lifetime, you will never be able to get the full membership again. Yeah, you can never become a bhikkhu again.
Who's responsible for kicking this person out?
That is the class. We will talk about the next piece again. We will start a new topic tomorrow, next Thursday. Thank you.